Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We thought the world's population was supposed to level off at a bulging 9 billion by the middle of this century. Yesterday, the UN, which has a pretty good track record on these forecasts, said no. Global population will keep climbing, it said, and may hit 10.1 billion by 2100. That raises all kinds of issues, not least the question of how much global poverty we may see in that number and what to do about it. We have in two of the biggest names in the field this hour on Point in the face of a wave of humanity radically rethinking global poverty. You can join the conversation. How do we handle this situation? How do we fight the misery, the poverty? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me today in the studio, two big thinkers on global poverty. Esther Duflo is co-founder of the Poverty Action Lab at MIT. Last year, she was awarded the John Bates Clark Medal, given to the best economist under 40. The year before, she was named a MacArthur Genius Fellow. Last month, she was named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time magazine. She's co-author of the new book, Poor Economics, A Radical Rethinking of the Way to Fight Global Poverty. Esther Duflo, thank you very much for being here.
Hello, thank you.
And with us, Duflo's co-author of Poor Economics and co-founder of the Poverty Action Lab, MIT economics professor Abhijit Banerjee. He's an advisor to the World Bank, to the government of India, knows much of what's going on in that world himself. Abhijit Banerjee, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
There's so much to look at here. Cutbacks in foreign aid on the table in Washington as the U.S. struggles with this country's fiscal problems. A lot of attitude in the American population of, wait a minute, let's work at home first. We've got a lot of that pouring in online right now. We'll look at that. And then as we prepared for today's show, these numbers coming out. I mean, there was this notion that the global population would level off at a high level, 9 billion. I mean, we're at 6 or 7 now. We'd go to 9, but at least level off somewhere. And now the numbers say it just keeps growing. Is there something implicit in that growth? Let me come first to you, Abhijit Banerjee. It was going to be 9 billion. Now it's going to be 10, more than 10. Does that mean necessarily that poverty goes right up with that around the world?
Not really. I think the poverty question, I think whether this is something that we should worry about it. I would say the first order reason to worry about it has something to do with the environment and the pressures on the environment. The relationship between population growth and poverty is less straightforward, and I would still say this creates pressures that will have to be dealt with, but whether or not this immediately translates into greater poverty, I think that's much less clear.
Impoverished populations can be very hard on the environment. Of course, the irony is, Esther Duflo, affluent populations are often indirectly even harder with all of their demands for resources and energy. When you look at these numbers, in your book with Abhijit, you write, we've got something just shy of a billion people now, I think you say, who live on something like 99 cents a day, real poverty, the heart of global poverty. If the numbers overall go up, do you think that number is going to go up too? Are we at grips with global poverty in a way that would keep a lid on it, or does it explode right alongside the overall population of the planet?
In the last few years, the number of people living under a dollar a day has tended to go down, because even though the number of people in the planet has gone up, the share of them who lived in extreme poverty has gone down. But we don't know whether that would reverse with the population growth going up, because it is true that part of this population growth is happening in quite poor country. So it is possible that we would see a reversal unless the world economy picks up in a way that allows the world as a whole to become richer, in which case we'll have more people but fewer of them very poor, and that will kind of level itself off.
I'm curious when I look at these numbers. I mean, they're talking about Yemen, which just had a few million people only a few years ago, now 25 million or so. They're talking about Yemen going to 100 million plus, Nigeria going to 700 and some million people. Is there no point at which poverty itself becomes a brake on population growth?
There's no, I think the evidence is the opposite, which is that it could happen, but mostly, at least thankfully in a sense, what we find is that as people get richer, they have fewer children. And I would say the most, I think the most solid evidence we have is that more educated people have fewer children. I think that's sort of the one, I think, relatively solid fact we know.
So, but a bigger population doesn't necessarily mean more educated or better off. It could be absolutely wretched if we run to the limits of our global resources.
Absolutely. So I think what you're saying is exactly right. And the real problem is how to find ways to deliver services to this growing population, especially because it's happening in the countries where the governance isn't great and the record of delivery isn't great. I mean, I think that's the real challenge, is that the Nigerias and the Yemens of the world are not famous for their effective delivery to the poor. And that's sort of what we should start worrying about right now.
Your big radical breakthrough has been to apply random testing to anti-poverty efforts around the world. You've got a lot of attention for that. We're going to look at that in this hour. But before we even get there, I think we've got to deal with something else. The cutbacks are already going on in foreign aid. President Obama says no, but Republicans in Congress say yes, and there's a lot of support for that. I'm looking here online. Here's one listener on the webpage says no. And I guess she's speaking to foreign aid. This is Carrie. She says, we need to take care of our own before we go wasting more on poor countries that will eventually use our kindness against us. And she says militarily. What about the basic argument for attacking global poverty today, Esther? How do you make it in a time when, right or wrong, Americans are not anywhere near as impoverished as many others, but people feel really up against the wall?
I think there are various arguments one can give, but one that links directly to the conversation we just had is think about population pressure as being a worldwide problem, as there are more people in the world, that puts more pressure in the entire planet. And therefore, this is not Nigeria's problem, this is our problem. And as Abhijit was saying earlier, a main driver of reduction in fertility and therefore reduction in population growth is when a country becomes somewhat richer, when infant mortality goes down, when education goes up, when people have security for their old age. So thinking about any way to reduce poverty, global poverty, could actually be a very smart, self-interested move from our end in our countries.
Abhijit, we've been hearing about fighting global poverty for many, many years now. And yet, you write in your book, Poor Economics, with Esther, in some ways it's a prescription for how to do it better, but it is implicitly a pretty tough critique on what we've done in all these years. After all the money that's been spent, all the effort that's been put out there, why hasn't it worked better?
Well, we've been shooting blind, mostly. I mean, I think that there's no difference between fighting poverty and running a business. You have to know what you're doing, try out the things that you want to see if they will work, figure out which of them work, put your money on the ones that work. And we just haven't had that culture. We've always gone on, wisdom, intuition, judgment of prominent people, ideology, but rarely on, tough evidence.
Give us some example, Esther or Abhijit, about efforts that have been put out there that the people thought by common sense would work but didn't.
Well, one interesting example linking to the conversation we were having earlier is how do you reduce population growth? How do you make it easier for people to have fewer children? And one obvious way is thinking, oh, there need to be more contraceptive out. And in fact, surprisingly, the effect of just making contraceptive available without other programs to encourage education and to encourage reasons to have fewer children has actually a quite limited effect on population. I wouldn't say no effect, but the evidence shows the effect to be relatively limited.
Just making contraceptives available, not enough.
Contraceptive available, not enough.
Why not? What does make it that effective?
Well, one very simple example, you make it available to women, or you make it available to women and men, and the difference and the effect are very different. If you make it only available to women and you make sure that they have a way to control their use and to conceal their use from their husband if necessary, mm-hmm. has an effect which is much larger than making it available to women and men together. This is from a study that was done in Zambia.
So women are more likely to take it up if they have the freedom, the access, and some maybe confidentiality and work with it.
Exactly. The confidentiality is essential. And I think a lot of people thought exactly the other way, that you would need to involve the men because the men need to be part of the decision, which may have been a perfectly reasonable intuition. But opposite to that is the fact that women and men have very different reasons to want to have children or not want to have children. In particular, if you're a woman in Africa, having one more child is one more chance to die in childbirth. So women are actually more likely to want fewer children. And if you give them the confidentiality, that allows them to just control it a little bit better.
You're working case by case on these anti-poverty efforts. When you look at these population numbers coming at us, do you despair? Do you think, oh my gosh, no matter what we do, we won't keep up?
Oh no, not at all. I don't despair. I think we, in the same way that this number increases now, they have a chance to decrease again or at mm-hmm. least at the rate of growth levels off, mm-hmm. as long as we understand what is the rationale for people's decision to have fewer or more children.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour at a time when the axe is out on foreign aid spending. We're talking about the best ways to help the world's poor, and this, the day after new numbers out from the United Nations, projecting that the global population will not level off, as it had been long supposed, asserted in the middle of this century at around 9 billion, but may instead keep growing right through the end of the century, 10 billion plus people. With me this hour, the co-authors of Poor Economics, Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee, are with me in the studio. They're both at MIT, at the Abdul Latif Jameel Poverty Action Lab. Big names in the world of fighting global poverty, with some big ideas about how to do it better, how to do it differently. We've talked in recent years with Jeffrey Sachs, who has one big idea about how to address global poverty, spend a whole lot more money on it. He was pushing a couple of years back in his book, The End of Poverty, for the rich world to commit another couple hundred billion dollars. He said if we did that over 20 years, we could do it. We could end poverty. At the other end of the scale, we talked with Dambisa Moyo, economist, used to work at Goldman Sachs, World Bank. She wrote a book called Dead Aid, saying she, as William Easterly has said, that aid does more harm than good. Now, in that spectrum, from pile it on to it does more harm than good, where do you two stand?
I guess we are mostly in favor of aid, just aid delivered to programs that have some reason to work. So I think if we could get to a world where most things that aid is spent on are actually things for which there's some solid evidence, I wouldn't be in favor of more aid.
What's going to make people confident that it's aid that has a reason to work if for decades your suggestion is we've been pouring it into things that don't work? How are humans all of a sudden going to become so much more responsible or insightful or trustworthy that these bad channels that you describe are changed?
Well, in part, what is going to make people more confident is demonstrated success. What has been lacking is an effort to check what works and what doesn't work. And in fact, we can check what works and what doesn't work in the same way that before you put a new drug on the market, you just do a randomized controlled trial and test it.
If we can do it, why haven't we in all these years? Are there political concerns that are actually bigger than the kind of careful testing that you're recommending?
I actually do not think that is the main issue. I think we haven't, just because we haven't, there is a lot of inertia in the way we are doing policy, not only in poor countries, that is also a problem in rich countries where we just do things the way we best think we should do them without really spending the time to put things to the test and to try things out. There is a big difference between business and policies. When you run a business, you try your best idea, and if it's not a very good idea, no one buys the product and you fold, or you try something different. But with policies, this automatic market test is absent, and therefore pretty bad policies have a tendency to just persist because nothing is there to tell them, hey, it's not working.
What's going to change that dynamic? You're laying out a prescription for changing it. But if it hasn't changed in all these years, it should be, no doubt is, shocking to people that we've been pouring money out without testing whether it's really effective or not. I mean, if that's something that, societies have been happy to do or have simply done all these years, what's going to change that? Do you two have the power? Can you just say, no more of that, it's done? I mean, how's that fundamental dynamic going to change?
Well, it is changing. It is changing. In part, I think the tools weren't there. The idea that you could apply the same kind of rigorous type of evaluation to policy as was done for drugs had not been fully realized in the policy sphere. But in the last 10, 15 years, this is getting more and more applied, both in poor countries and also in our countries. And I think this is already making a difference in how effective programs are. And this is only the very beginning of a potential radical change.
Abhijit, give us an example, something that's been tested and through testing found to work, maybe improved, that offers us the proof positive that, this is not a waste, this can work, and that we've discovered that through the kind of careful observation you're promoting.
So the one very nice example is deworming drugs.
Deworming for some people don't have worms, which is going to cut into their health and their vigor and everything else.
Yes. So you get anemia, you get tired, you don't go to school. And I think so at some point about like 12 years ago or something, there was a randomized controlled trial where kids in Kenya were given deworming drugs. Mm-hmm. And some schools were chosen through a lottery, and the kids there were given these drugs. Other schools were not chosen, and mm-hmm. they were left as a control. They compared them. They found that when you look at the schools where people get deworming drugs, these children come to school more often. They're more energetic. Mm-hmm. They kept following these kids. So now, 10 years after this happened, they once again went and looked at what happened to the kids that got the drugs. And they find that those kids actually earn something like a quarter more than the ones who didn't get the drugs.
So very significant.
Very large effects. So, and this is now very, and this was then tested out in, there's been similar data that was got from the historical data from the U.S. when the worms were a big problem here, from India. And when you put that data together, it makes a very compelling case. And since then, there's been an organization set up as a part of it called Deworm the World, which has taken on this agenda and has approached governments, and has a number of governments, including the government of Kenya, have decided, well, all kids have to be dewormed. And so it's growing apace, actually. A number of major state governments in India, states in India are bigger than many countries, so are taking that on. So it's something that's, I think the evidence just compelled people that this is something there's no reason to sit and watch. I mean, you could just do it.
So simple, maybe so effective. In your book, you really push back against sort of big, grand theories and statements. You like a lot of these modest, ground-level steps that change things in a very, maybe small, but very material way, maybe with big leverage. But can you put enough programs equivalent to this, deworming, together to really change global poverty? I mean, do they add up to the solution, Esther?
I think they do. If you take just deworming, it sort of adds up to a part of the solution on its own. If you're looking at 20% more income every year, this is more than Kenya has been able to achieve in several years of growth. And if you look at other programs, like, for example, improving the quality of education, mm-hmm. where One big issue in developing countries is that although many children are in school, they don't learn very much in school. And it turns out that it is not that difficult to actually teach them.
Please tell us, because we have that problem right here.
One of the problems in developing countries, which I think is a little bit different from a problem we have here, is that the teaching tends to be very much targeted to the top of the class.
The top students in a class or the top students in a society, in a classroom?
The top student in a classroom at best, mm-hmm. and sometime maybe the top student in society who mm-hmm. might not even be in the classroom, mm-hmm. the ideal student.
Right.
And therefore, most students are very, very lost in class. And when you have programs like remedial education, that can make a huge difference if you decide that you are going to be focusing on the basics. You're going to be focusing on reading and on counting and on basic writing. And when you focus on that, we've participated in experiments in Kenya, in India. These experiments are now being scaled up in Ghana, where this effort at remedial education makes an enormous difference in the ability of children to read. And of course, when a child is literate, many, many things follow. They have fewer children, they earn more as adults, they raise healthier children themselves, their children will have more education, etc. So this beginning is actually the beginning of a real transformation.
Deworming, basic, effective education, these things seem so obvious in a way, so simple, that it's kind of shocking that these constitute a radical rethinking, as you have in your title, of how we fight global poverty. Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee are with me, co-authors of Poor Economics, looking at global poverty on a day when we have the news that the world's global population is headed up higher than we thought. Let me turn to our listeners. Nick in Weston, Massachusetts. Nick, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
I think your two guests are very correct. There are many small foreign aid projects that are very effective, and I think they're balanced generally in their views, and I'm really pleased to hear them, because there's so many people, some who've been on your program, Tom, who love to put down foreign aid. It's very fashionable to say that it's a waste of money. It's far smaller amount of money than most people think in this country,
mm-hmm.
and I have done decades of evaluations of health and family planning programs, many paid by U.S. taxpayers and some U.N. programs, and your guests are right. The small-scale health programs, which are community-based, primary health care, helping women prevent or spread out pregnancies, they can be very helpful. I do have one bone to pick, though. My evaluations show that the men should be involved, along with their spouses, in planning families. It's not fair to say that men always want more kids and women don't. There are many studies that we've done that show that men who have to pay the bills and have to raise children responsibly accept that responsibility, and they often promote family planning, whereas the women, whose status often depends on having lots of kids, often want more children than their husbands. So I think, Esther, you're incorrect to generalize about just leaving the men out. The men should be involved. Ideally, both parents need to decide how many children they can care for.
Nick, let us pick it up right there. This is interesting. I mean, Nick is applauding your way of approaching it, but then he's saying he's got a different answer on studies of his own. If your work and its effectiveness is based on close study, random testing, but here you've got perhaps conflicting studies. First of all, what about his point? Men should be in there. And secondly, how does your theory proceed if you have conflicting studies? What happens then? Is that paralysis?
So the demographic and health surveys are a series of surveys that are done around the world in very, very many countries. And they tend to ask this question of women and of men, how many children do you want to have? So that allows to compare simply the answers that men and women give to this question. And it turns out that it is generally the case that men want more children than women. So that's it might be that in a country, in a particular country where Nick was, this was different, but this tends to be, in at least in a lot of African countries, the situation. Now, the question about whether you can generalize from a particular study, like this study was done in Lusaka, Zambia, by two Harvard researchers, does it generalize to another setting? Well, the listener put it exactly right, which is it depends on whether, in this context, women or men want more children, presumably. And then the person who is given control, if they are the one who want fewer children, that's going to have a bigger effect on reducing population.
So it's a cultural question, an economic question. It may vary country by country. If you have that variation, can you come up with a global solution, or that's not the point?
Well, what you come up with, rather than a global solution out of just one program, is global insights, which is, here the insight would be the person who is given control, because they are given access to the fertility control method, is the person who is going to have an influence in the choice. And we need to take that into account in designing programs. That's an insight which probably generalizes from program to program. And then that insight modulates in different way depending on the relative preferences of men and women in different contexts.
Let's get another call. Another Nick here from Norwich, Connecticut. Hi, Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, Rampant Nicks.
Yes.
I guess for hundreds of years, people have been projecting the inability of the world to carry increased population. But now there is a new and incredibly potent factor here, global warming, which is going to flood incredible amounts of land, often agricultural land. Fishing stocks are already declining. Did this study factor in that there's going to be less land, less productive farming land, less fish, less everything? Because if it didn't, I mean, Mother Nature may be having the last word here, which may lead to an entirely different result. So I guess the question is, did this study factor this kind of thing in?
Rampant Nick, let us look at it. Abhijit, what about it? You've got lots of sort of close focus suggestions here, but we've got big factors as well, in politics, economic structures, war. Caller Nick looks at global warming and says, will this pull the rug out from underneath the kind of multifarious efforts that you're proposing?
I guess, to the extent that global warming is something we can do anything about, the answers will come from the same kinds of efforts. We need to know, what's the cheapest way to get people to, you know, use less polluting fuels. We need to think of what's the most effective way to get people to have less children. We need to think of the most effective ways of rescuing those populations that are going to be under threat from these kinds of already put in place disasters that are going to happen over the next 30, 40 years. So I completely agree with Nick that this is a concern, and that. But I don't think that the answers to any of these questions will come from saying, let's just shoot blind. I mean, it's the same principle, which is that each of these questions needs a delicate understanding of what the incentives of the participants are and how to act effectively in the environment defined by those incentives.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today at a time when the axe is out on foreign aid spending, about the best ways to help the world's poor, with Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee. They are co-founders of the Poverty Action Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, much celebrated, and co-authors of the new book, Poor Economics, A Radical Rethinking of the Way to Fight Global Poverty. Talking with them on the day we have news that the planet's population, human population, may be headed over 10 billion. No leveling off in the middle of this century, the UN now says, but up to 10.1 billion, I should say, by the year 2100, and maybe beyond that. Here's a comment from Rick. He says there are millions in this country that need help. Yes, it's true, poverty is relative. The poor here in the U.S. might be light years ahead of those who live in squalor elsewhere, but still we must address the needs of our own nation before taking on the rest of the world, particularly in times of austerity. Private charities are free to do as they please. Of course, I'm talking about the government's role here. What about that perspective right now, Esther Duflo?
Well, first of all, he's right. Rick is right. There are a million of people in poverty here as well. And the same type of approaches would be productively employed here as well. The same type of problems of figuring out what would really work in schools, what would really work in inner cities, what would really work to prevent teenage pregnancies, etc., are the same type of questions emerge here, and which we would be well advised to spend the same type of effort figuring out how to solve them.
But that brings me back to the same question. If that hasn't been figured out in this country, with all of its resources and with all of its, you know, highly trained people and with all of its generally educated population, if we don't even figure out here, how does it get figured out in the third world?
There's no...
Since figuring it out is not just an intellectual exercise, I mean, you present a kind of a rational universe. We may have answers to these things, but that doesn't mean that that's what gets acted on. It doesn't mean that that's what happens. Looking at this big population burst projected today, well, we've spent years, we in this country, with policies that have deliberately cut back on contraceptives to the rest of the world, on religious and other grounds, during the Bush administration, for example. So, you know, who says there's a rational universe at work here to even push the potential solutions you're proposing, Abhijit?
I guess, you know, there's obviously no guarantee that sense is what political systems deliver. But if you don't give them the inputs, then it's guaranteed that they won't. So I'm pretty confident that if we change the conversation, and I think the conversation is changing, I see it across the board in developing countries, in the U.S., where people are much more willing to say, look, we know that we are kind of failing. Let's try this out and see if it works. And I think that mindset, one way to think about it is, yes, it's been a while, 50 years of aid or something. On the other side, you can think about it, this is 50 years, a drop in the ocean. We've had poverty for 5,000 years or whatever, and we haven't solved it. And we just started trying to solve it for the last 60 years. And now we say, well, it's failed, let's give up. That seems way too soon. I mean, it's in the global context of history of poverty, this is a drop in the ocean. I think we are in a good position to sort of change mindsets, move forward.
Here's another. I mean, there's a lot of skepticism out there. Esther, let me give this one to you. It's from Gustavo online. It says, come on, guys. You know that when the U.S. says foreign aid, what we really mean is sending poor countries lots of dollars so they can turn around and then buy lots of weapons systems from General Electric, General Dynamics, all the retired generals out hawking guns, missiles, choppers around the world. Oh, my gosh. And, of course, those generals then use a big chunk of sales to lobby and donate to our representatives. It's an elegant money laundering scheme. The American schlubs dazed on Idol think their tax money on American Idol, I guess, is think their tax money is going to feed the world when in reality it goes to feed more pigs at the trough. We got some tough customers in our listenership today, Esther. What about this perspective?
Well, there is some truth to that. If you take all of the money that has been spent on military aid to Egypt every year until last year, mm-hmm. you could have taken all this money and given $20 per African child under 5 for every single African child. That is a number that is useful to have in mind. It is true that a lot of our aid is not aid. A lot of our aid is military money. But I think that's fine. That's the fact. Let's put it on one side. Now let's look at the rest, the one that is actually spent on Africa, because there is a little bit of it that is spent on Africa. And let's look at, as well as all of the money that is being spent by the African government themselves on their own people. And still the question remains, how do we make this money go as far as possible? How do we get this money to be spent the most efficiently possible? And I'm absolutely convinced that if we can prove that the money is actually being useful, that will actually encourage the more skeptical customers to actually be more generous.
Here's a question then from Ellen. She's listening carefully as we speak, and she's noticing the "we" that you're using. We can do this, we can do that. She says, Duflo keeps referring to we and our policy. She says, reading this thread, it seems that national politics, country by country, is pretty basic. So in Libya, we would be Gaddafi in his team and writer. Who's the we that you're referring to, Ellen asks? Who is the we that might someday implement this approach?
That's a great question. I see we as a very expensive we. I think we is the word
expensive.
Encompassing. Mm-hmm. We. I think we is in a sense the world at large. Part of the problem in the way we are thinking, we people are thinking about helping the poor is that we tend to think that it is someone else's job. It is the job of the UN, or maybe it is the job of their government.
But when it's everyone's job, we are the world, it's no one's job in a sense as well. Maybe the thinking we have to share, maybe a consensus grows there, but to be, I guess specifically, to be implemented through what? Are you thinking at core USA policy, UN policy, some other country, some other organization?
It's at various levels. So it's in the government of these countries themselves. Mm-hmm. The efficiency of their policies have to be improved. The way foreign aid is being sent, the efficiency of that aid has to be improved. The way NGOs work, charity, etc., charitable giving, the efficiency of that money has to be improved. The way young people in this country and other go and volunteer, the efficiency of that can also be improved if their efforts go into the right place. This is why it is we, a general we, even though when we focus on specific issues, the responsibility of every person on that particular issue becomes quite specific. If it's about education, mm-hmm. we mm-hmm. is the parents who need to send their kids to school, the kid who needs to actually go to school and not like turn right
to
school,
yeah, sure.
the teacher who has to teach to the kids, the supervisor of the teacher who has to give the teacher a reasonable job, the country that has to spend enough money on education, etc., etc. And it becomes quite specific and not at all vague once you actually look at specific issues, like not how is poverty going to be gone in the world, but how are children going to learn in school? How are children going to be immunized? How are we going to ensure
some actor has to send the impulse down through all these channels for this to happen. Or maybe it rises from below if everybody reads Poor Economy. I'm not sure. Bernice in Fort Ann, New York. Bernice, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the program and what the speakers have been saying. My first mm-hmm. question that it actually had to do with how much military aid we gave as opposed to giving education and family planning. So you answered that. But my second question had to do with the role of the church, particularly because I was in Guatemala, and I agree with what you said earlier, where many, many, many women had to keep secret their use of contraception from their husband because otherwise they couldn't take it, but also the role of the evangelical and the Catholic Church in terms of not only not supporting family planning, but actually making the women feel sinful for wanting some control over their bodies and over family planning, and that has been an obstacle, not a help, in terms of trying to create better conditions and less population growth and less poverty.
Bernice, let us pick it up. Abhijit, what about cultural factors, religion included, when it comes to implementing your kind of rational view of how development ought to occur? Bernice looks at the church in particular.
I guess to the extent that our evidence has much to say about this, I would say I think the most striking thing we find is that people often will tell you that this is a cultural factor, it's an immutable fact about people in this country. And then you find out that, you know, in fact, it just is a matter of, you know, you change something small in what you're doing and things just change radically. We were working on immunization in India, and the striking fact there was so many people told us, you know, these people don't get immunized because they have deep beliefs that they're not, you know, it's you know, they get the evil eye if the child got immunized or something. The child mm-hmm. get evil. Mm-hmm.
But that's powerful.
That's powerful, except it's not true. When we went,
many untrue things are powerful, I suppose.
Alas, you're right. What we had done was we had offered every mother who got her child immunized 1 kilo of dried lentils. Okay.
Oh, And suddenly the great fear evaporates?
Yes, great fear evaporates. It doesn't evaporate, but, 20 percentage point people, more people get their child fully immunized. It just has a massive effect. If people were that hidebound and sort of stuck in the tradition, you wouldn't see any of this.
Be practical, you're saying. Now, Jim in Charleston, South Carolina, Jim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom, Esther, Abhijit, and listeners. I have an idea, and I think it might be a good one, but it may not, and I'm wondering, Esther and Abhijit, what you think about this. What about actually paying someone to eradicate poverty after the fact, as in, if it were in my town, it would be, hey, there's this family, they're poor, establish what eradicating poverty means for them. This kind of nutrition improvement, this education improvement, this housing improvement, this income established job, and pay someone who can do it, but they get paid when they do it.
Hey, Jim, would you take that deal? Jim, if we offer you that job right now, will you take it with no pay until you're successful?
Well, that's what all business people do. It's an intertemporal investment of capital, and the income comes only later when the job is finished, when the restaurant is open and the dinners are being served, or when the items are coming out the other door.
Yeah, when they're up in the rails and it's all working. Esther, how about it? Can we put out, 6,000 contracts that will pay make good on after everybody's not impoverished anymore?
That's actually a very interesting suggestion. It turns out that something a little bit similar was implemented in Indonesia and tested out in one experiment conducted by our colleague at MIT, Ben Olken. There, it is not individual people, but communities that were promised a bonus payment on top of their normal revenue so that they could function anywhere, and that solves the cash flow problem mm-hmm. that Tom was talking about. On top of that, they were promised a bonus if they managed to reduce the number of kids that are not immunized, to increase the number of kids that go to school, etc., etc. And they had a number of indicators that they could be targeting. And this was actually extremely effective in getting this stuff up. So I think there is a lot of good insight in your suggestion.
Who's picking up materially, practically, on your approach here? Are there big agencies, big governments who are doing it right now? Have you talked with Republicans and congresspeople in Washington? Are they willing to keep foreign aid flowing if you put some very tough metrics to it and measure it sort of day by day, year by year? Or do they roll their eyes at you and say, look, forget about it, get out of here?
I guess one thing that I want to say is I think right now USAID is really going through a renaissance. And I think you see them.
I thought its funding was all up for grabs.
Yeah, that's what I was going to come back to. So I think they have, under new leadership, they brought in a bunch of people who actually we worked with in the past closely. Mm-hmm. And these people come in with, a very tough-minded attitude towards spending money and getting value from it and looking at the evidence.
How do cuts affect them, Ben?
So cuts are really terrible. I mean, this was all going to say that, in fact, we haven't spoken to the Republicans, but I wish they were listening, because I think that assuming they also want, in the end, value for money, this is the time where USAID is in a position with a mindset of trying to deliver value for money. And what will happen if the cuts are unfortunate, because what cuts will hurt most are the new innovative efforts, because everything else
those
is
will go first, the old yeah. sort of grandfathered in things will go roll on.
Exactly. Maybe.
Esther, what if we fail? What if we don't adopt this kind of approach? What if we don't become more effective at fighting global poverty than we have been in these decades we've been talking about, as the planet's population apparently rockets even higher than we expected? What consequences?
I think it would be the continuation of a disaster, so to speak. I think the level of poverty we have today in the world is something that we should see as unacceptable. Or at least I see mm-hmm. as unacceptable.
Absolutely.
From a moral point of view, mm-hmm. from also from sustainability of our own existence point of view, we were talking about this population pressure, etc. We mm-hmm. really have to see it as unacceptable. And I think it is a responsibility of humankind to tackle this problem here and now, and we can. Now, I think we won't fail because, again, who is we? We is sufficiently different people that if the U.S. is not going to take it on, India is going to take it on, China is going to take it on.
For its own population or for global populations?
For its own population first.
Those are pretty big.
Maybe for global population as well.
Why will they do it if the U.S. doesn't? Why would they, hypothetically?
In part because the responsibility of caring for other people also exists in those countries. As India becomes richer, as China becomes richer, they become more attuned of the rest of the world. One interesting example is some programs that have been very successful in Bangladesh, for example, are now spreading in other countries in the world. Some programs that have been successful in India are spreading in other countries in the world, like Ghana, for example. I think if the U.S. is not going to take the leadership in spreading the innovation, then the innovation is going to spread from other countries. And to be honest, I think that's a good thing.
Maybe Bangladesh will lead. There's a thought.
Yes. They already are.
There's a thought. They already are. You open our eyes and our ears in the face of some big numbers out there. Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee, co-authors of Poor Economics, A Radical Rethinking of the Way to Fight Global Poverty. Thank you so much to each of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.